while her husband, glass in hand, was watching Marcel with satisfaction. "Did you see the teacher cross the yard?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"Did you see him go to the tool shed?"
"No, monsieur. He was coming back from it."
"You saw him coming out of the shed?"
"I saw him shutting the door. Then he crossed the yard and I whispered to the others, 'Watch out!' Everyone returned to their seats, me too."
"Do you play a lot with your classmates?"
"Not a lot, no."
"You don't like to play?"
"I'm too fat."
He blushed saying that and glanced at his father as if in apology. "Don't you have any friends?"
"Mostly I have Joseph."
"Who is Joseph?"
"The Rato's son."
"The mayor's son?" Now Julien Cellier spoke up.
"We have many Ratos in Saint-André and hereabouts," he explained. "Almost all of them cousins. Joseph is the son of Marcelin Rato, the butcher."
Maigret drank a swallow of wine and relit the pipe he had let go out. "Was Joseph near you, at the window?"
"He wasn't in school. For a month he's had to stay home because of his accident."
"He's the boy who was knocked down by a motorbike?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"You were with him when that happened?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"Do you go to see him often?"
Almost every day."
"Did you go there yesterday?"
"No."
"The day before?"
"Not then, either."
"Why?"
"Because of what happened. Everyone was busy with the crime."
"I suppose you wouldn't have dared lie to the police lieutenant."
"No, sir."
"Are you pleased that the teacher's in prison?"
"No, sir."
"Do you realize that he's there because of your statement?"
"I don't know what you mean."
"If you'd not said that you'd seen him leaving the tool shed, he would probably not have been arrested." Abashed, the boy said nothing, shifting from one leg to the other, glancing again at his father. "If you really did see him, you were right to tell the truth."
"I told the truth."
"Didn't you like Léonie Bira?"
"No, monsieur."
"Why not?"
"Because when I went by, she would shout nasty words at me."
"At you, more than at the others?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"Do you know why?"
"Because she's angry at Mama for having married my father."
Maigret half closed his eyes, looking for another question to ask, found none, and decided to empty his glass. He stood up rather heavily, for he'd already drunk a fair amount of white wine that morning. "Thank you, Marcel. If you had something further to tell me, if you were to remember a detail you'd forgotten, for example, I'd like you to come and see me right away. You're not afraid of me?"
"No, monsieur."
"Another?"
asked the father, reaching for the bottle. "No, thank you. I don't want to keep you from your lunch any longer." "Your son is a smart boy, Monsieur Cellier."
The tinsmith blushed with pleasure.
"Oh, we're raising him the best we can. I don't think he often lies."
"On that point, when did he speak to you about the teacher going to the shed?"
"Wednesday evening."
"He said nothing on Tuesday, when the whole village was talking about Léonie Birard's death."
"No, I think he was intimidated. At dinner on Wednesday, he seemed different and suddenly said to me, 'Papa, I think I saw something.' He told me about it, and I went to repeat it to the police lieutenant."
"Thank you." Something was bothering him. He didn't quite know what. Outside, he went first to the Bon Coin, where he saw the substitute teacher eating near the window while reading a book. He remembered that he'd intended to call his wife, went on to the post office, which was in a different group of houses, and was served by a young woman of about 25, wearing a black smock.
"Will it take a long time to get through to Paris?"
"Not at this hour, Monsieur Maigret."
While waiting for his call, he watched her doing her accounts, and wondered if she were married, if she would get married one day, if she would turn into someone like the old Bira woman. He spent about 5 minutes in the booth, and all that the young woman heard through the door was,
"No, no oysters, because there aren't any." "No, all the weather's splendid, not chilly at all."
He decided it was lunchtime. The teacher was still at Louis's place, and Maigret found himself sitting at the table opposite his. The entire village already knew who he was. Although they were not greeting him, they followed him with their eyes in the street, and as soon as he'd passed, began to talk about him. The teacher looked up from his book 3 or 4 times. As he was leaving, he seemed to hesitate. Perhaps he wanted to tell him something. It was unclear. In any case, when he went past, he gave Maigret a nod that could have been taken
for an involuntary twitch.
Thérèse was wearing a fresh white apron over her black dress. Louis was eating in the kitchen, where he could sometimes be heard calling her. When he finished, he came over to Maigret, his lips still greasy.
"So, what did you think of it, that rabbit?"
"It was excellent."
"A spot of brandy to wash it down? On the house?"
He had a protective way of looking at the inspector, as if without him, Maigret would have been lost in the jungle of Saint-André.
"He's quite a character,"
he rumbled as he sat down, spreading his knees to accommodate his belly.
"Who?" "Théo. I don't know anyone shrewder than he is. He's always managed to enjoy life without lifting a finger."
"So, you believe that no one else heard that gunshot?"
"First off, out here in the country, nobody pays any attention to a rifle going off. If it had been a shotgun, everyone would have noticed. Besides, those things don't make much noise, and we've got so used to them now that all the kids have them."
"Théo was in his garden and supposedly didn't see a thing."
"In his garden or in his wine storeroom? Because what he calls gardening is mostly going off to draw a glass from the barrel. Mind you, if he did see something, he probably wouldn't say anything."
"Even if he saw someone fire the shot?"
"Especially then."
Pleased with himself, Louis was filling the little glasses.
"I warned you that you wouldn't understand a thing."
"Do you think that the teacher tried to kill the old woman?"
"And you?"
"No," said Maigret firmly.
Louis looked at him, smiling as if to say, "Neither do I." But he did not say it. Perhaps they were each feeling as sluggish as the other, after all they'd eaten and drunk. They sat for a moment in silence, looking out at the square cut in two by the sun, the greenish windows of the cooperative, the stone portal of the church.
"What's the priest like?" asked Maigret, just to say something.
"He's a priest."
"Is he on the teacher's side?"
"Against."
Maigret finally stood up, hesitated for a moment in the centre of the room, then took the lazy way out and headed for the stairs.
"Wake me in an hour,"
he told Thérèse. He should not have been so informal with her. The men of the police judiciaire had the habit of treating women like her that way, and it did not escape Louis, who frowned. The green shutters of the room were closed. Only thin shafts of sunlight came through. He didn't undress, merely took off his jacket and shoes and stretched out on the bedspread. A little later, when he was just dozing, he thought he heard the rhythmic sound of the sea. Was it possible? Ben fell completely asleep, waking only at the knock on his door.
"It's been an hour, Monsieur Maigret. Would you like a cup of coffee?"
He still felt heavy, groggy, unsure of exactly what he wanted to do. When he crossed the room downstairs, four men were playing cards, including Théo and Marcelin, the butcher, still in his work clothes. The inspector continued to sense that some detail was amiss, but couldn't tell which one. He'd first had that feeling during his questioning of the Cellier boy, at precisely which moment of their conversation. He began to walk first towards Léonie Birard's house, the key to which was in his pocket. He went inside, sat down in the front room, and read all the letters he'd seen there that morning. He found nothing important in them, and simply became familiar with certain names, the Dubas, Cornu, Gillet, Brateau, Boncoeur. Leaving the house, he intended to follow the road all the way to the sea, but a little further along he saw the cemetery, and turned in there, where he read on the gravestones more or less the same names he'd found in the letters. He could have pieced together the history of these families, proving that the Rateaus had been allied with the Dubars for two generations, and that a Cornu had married a Piedbeuf, who died at the age of 26. As he walked 200 or 300 meters further along the road, the sea remained invisible. The meadows sloped gently upwards, while in the distance he saw only a glistening mist, which he gave up trying to reach. The villagers encountered him in the streets and alleys, his hands in his pockets, stopping sometimes for no reason to look at some facade or passerby. Before going to the village hall, he could not resist having a white wine. The four men were still playing cards, and Louis, straddling a chair, was looking on. The front steps of the village hall were in the sun, and at the end of the corridor, out in the kitchen gardens, he could see the caps of the two policemen. No doubt they were still hunting for the cartridge case. The windows of the teacher's house were closed. In the classroom, the children's heads were all in rows. He found the lieutenant annotating in red pencil the official report of an interrogation.
Come in, sir. I've seen the examining magistrate. He questioned Gaston this morning.
How is he?
Like a man who's just spent his first night in prison. He was worried that you might already have left.
I suppose that he still denies everything.
More than ever.
Has he a theory of his own?
He doesn't believe that anyone tried to kill the postmistress. He thinks it was an act of harassment instead, which proved fatal. People often played mean tricks on her.
On Léonie Bérard?
Yes. Not just the children. The adults as well. You know how it goes when villagers target someone they dislike. Whenever there was a dead cat, it would be tossed into her garden, if not through a window of her house. 2 weeks ago, she found her door smeared with excrement. According to the teacher, someone shot at her to scare or infuriate her.
And the shed?
He continues to claim that he never set foot there on Tuesday.
Did he do any gardening on Tuesday morning, before school?
Not Tuesday, but Monday. He gets up at 6 every morning. That's the only time he has a moment to himself. Did you see the cellier boy? What do you think of him?
He answered my questions without any hesitation.
Mine too, without once contradicting himself. I questioned his classmates, who all affirm that he did not leave the classroom after playtime. I assume that if he were lying, someone would certainly have somehow given him away.
I think so too. Do we know who inherits?
We still haven't found a will. Madame Cellier seems the likely heir.
Have you determined what her husband was doing all Tuesday morning?
He was busy in his workshop.
Has anyone confirmed that?
His wife, first of all. Then the blacksmith, Marchandon, who went to speak to him.
At what time?
He isn't exactly sure. Before 11, he says. He claims they chatted for at least 15 minutes. That doesn't prove a thing, obviously. He riffled through his papers. All the more so in that young Cellier himself says that the forge was in use at the moment when the teacher left the classroom.
So his father might therefore have gone out.
Yes, but don't forget that everyone knows him. He would have had to cross the square and go into the gardens. If he had gone by with a rifle, people would have noticed him all the more.
But they might not mention it.
In short, nothing was certain. There was no solid foundation aside from two contradictory statements. The one from Marcel Cellier, who claimed to have seen from the school window the teacher leaving the tool shed, and the other from Gaston, who swore he had never set foot in it that day. These were recent events. The questioning of the villagers had begun by Tuesday evening and continued throughout Wednesday. Everyone's memories were fresh. If the teacher had not fired the shot, what reason would he have to lie? And above all, what reason did he have to kill Léonie Bérard? Marcel Cellier had no more reason to invent the story about the shed, either.
Théo, for his part, grumpily stated that he'd heard a shot, but seen nothing. Had he been in his kitchen garden? In his wine storeroom?
There was no way to rely on the times mentioned by any of them, because country people don't pay much attention to the time, unless it's time to eat.
Maigret had no confidence either in accounts of this or that person passing by in the street at a particular moment. People used to seeing others 10 times a day in the same familiar places no longer pay attention, and can, in complete good faith, confuse one encounter with another, or affirm that something took place on Tuesday when it had happened on Monday. The wine was making him feel hot.
What time is the funeral?
At 9. Everyone will be there. It isn't every day you have the pleasure of burying the village shrew. Have you thought of something?
Maigret shook his head, drifted around the office, fiddled with the rifles, the cartridges.
You did tell me that the doctor isn't sure about the time of death.
He puts it between 10 and 11 that morning.
So that without young Cellier's testimony...
They always came back to that, and each time Maigret had the same impression that he was narrowly missing the truth, that he'd been on the verge, at one point, of discovering it.
Léonie Bérard did not interest him.
What did he care whether someone had wanted to kill or simply frighten her, or whether it had been an accident that the bullet had entered her left eye? It was Gaston's situation that fascinated him, and therefore the Cellier boy's statement as well. He went to the courtyard, and was halfway across when the children were let out of school, emerging less boisterously than at playtime and heading for the exit in small groups. Brothers and sisters could be spotted. Some bigger girls were holding smaller kids by the hand, and some children would have to cover more than 2 kilometers to get home.
Only one boy greeted him, aside from Marcel Cellier, who politely removed his cap. The others went by, eyeing him with curiosity. The teacher was in the doorway. Maigret went over, and a young man stepped aside for him, stammering,
Do you want to speak to me?
Not particularly. Had you already come to Saint-André before?
No, this is the first time. I've taught at La Rochelle and Foura.
Do you know Joseph Gaster?
No.
The desks and benches were black, covered with gouges, and violent ink stains made bronze reflections on the varnish. Maigret went to the first window on the left, saw one section of the yard, the gardens, the tool shed. From the window to the right, he could then see the back of the Birard house.
Did you notice anything today? In the children's attitudes?
They're more withdrawn than city children. Perhaps it's from timidity.
They weren't huddling together or passing notes during class.
The substitute wasn't even 22 years old and was visibly intimidated by Maigret, not so much because he was from the police, but because he was famous. The teacher would probably have behaved the same way before a noted politician or a film star.
I must say that I didn't pay any attention to that. Should I have?
What do you think of young Cellier?
One moment. Which one is he? I don't know all the names yet.
A boy, taller and sturdy than the others. A very good pupil.
The teacher looked at the first seat on the front bench, which was evidently Marcel's place, and Maigret went over to sit there, although unable to slide his legs under the low desk. From that spot, he saw, through the second window, not the kitchen gardens, but the linden in the yard and the Gaston's house.
He didn't seem anxious to you. Troubled?
No. I remember quizzing him in arithmetic and noting that he was very smart.
To the right of the Gaston's house could be seen, further along, the second-story windows of two other houses.
I might ask you for permission tomorrow to come and see the children for a moment during class.
I'll be available. We're staying at the same inn, I believe. It'll be easier for me if I prepare my lesson plans over here.
Maigret left him and was about to cross to the teacher's house. It was not Madame Gaston he wanted to see, but Jean-Paul. Halfway there, he noticed a curtain moving and stopped, put off by the idea of finding himself once again in a small, stifling room before the unhappy faces of a mother and son. His courage gave way to a feeling of laziness, absorbed, no doubt, from the rhythms of village life, the white wine, the sun beginning to vanish behind the roofs. After all, what was he doing there? 100 times in the middle of an investigation, he'd had the same feeling of helplessness, or rather futility. He would find himself abruptly plunged into the lives of people he'd never met before, and his job was to discover their most intimate secrets. This time, as it happened, it wasn't even his job. He was the one who'd chosen to come, because a teacher had waited for him for hours in purgatory at the police judiciaire. The air was taking on a blue tint, becoming cooler, more humid. Windows were lighting up here and there, and Marchenon's forge stood out in red, with dancing flames visible at each puff of the bellows. In the shop across the way, two women were as still as figures in an advertisement, with only their lips moving slightly. They seemed to be speaking each in turn, and after every sentence, the shopkeeper would nod sadly.
Were they talking about Léonie Birard?
Probably.
And about the funeral the next day, which would be a memorable event in the history of Saint-André.
The men were still playing cards. They doubtless wore away hours like that every afternoon, exchanging the same remarks, reaching occasionally for their glasses, and wiping their lips. He was about to go inside, ask for a carafe, and sit in a corner to wait for dinner, when a car stopped startlingly close to him.
Oh, did I scare you?
Called the doctor cheerily.
You haven't ferreted out the truth yet.
He emerged from the car, lit a cigarette.
It doesn't look like a Grand Boulevard,
he remarked, waving at the village around them, the dimly lit shop windows, the forge, the half-open church portal emitting a faint gleam.
You should see it in the depths of winter. Have you begun to get used to our village routines?
Léonie Birard kept letters addressed to different people.
She was an old bitch. Some folk called her the louse. If you knew how frightened she was of dying.
Was she ill?
Deathly ill. Only she wasn't dying.
Like Teo, who ought to have died at least 10 years ago, and who continues to drink his 4 daily liters of white wine, not counting the aperitifs.
What do you think of the Celliers?
They do what they can to join the middle class. Julien arrived here as a welfare ward and has worked hard to make a place for himself. They've only the one son.
I know. He's smart.
Yes.
Maigret sensed some reserve in the doctor's voice.
What do you mean?
Oh, nothing. He's a well-brought-up child. He's an altar boy. He's the priest's pet.
Another one who didn't like priests, apparently.
Do you think he lied?
I didn't say that. I don't believe anything. If you've been a country doctor for 22 years, you'd be like me. All that interests them is to earn money, change it into gold, put the gold into bottles and bury the bottles in their garden. Even when they're ill or hurt, it has to pay.
I don't understand.
There are always insurance policies or benefits, some way to turn everything into money.
He sounded almost like the postman.
A bunch of crooks,
he concluded in a tone that seemed to belie his words.
They're funny. I'm fond of them.
Even Léonie Bira?
She was a phenomenon.
And Germaine Gastin?
She'll spend her life torturing herself and the others, because she slept with Chevasseau. I bet they didn't do it often, perhaps only one time. And just when for once in her life she'd enjoyed some pleasure. If you're still here tomorrow, come and have lunch with me. This evening I have to go to La Rochelle.
Night had fallen. Maigret still lingered on the square, emptied his pipe by tapping the bowl against one heel, and entered the Bon Coin with a sigh, heading for a table that was already his table, while Thérèse, without asking, set a glass and a carafe of white wine at his place. Across from him, Théo, cards in hand, flashed him a look sparkling with malice, which meant,
"You're getting there. You're getting there. Another few years on that diet, and you'll be like all the others."
Chapter 6 The Postmistress's Funeral. It was not because of a postmistress's funeral, due to take place that day, that Maigret awakened with a weight on his shoulders. The death of Léonie Bira, in broad daylight, had not distressed anyone or offered any dramatic interest, and in the village and on their farms, the people of Saint-André must have been dressing for her burial service as gaily as for a wedding. In fact, Louis Pumel, out in the courtyard early on in a starched white shirt and black cloth trousers, but no collar or tie, was filling an impressive number of carafes with wine. Carafes, he said, not only behind the counter, but on the kitchen table as well, as if for a village fair. The men were shaving. Everyone would be in black, as though the entire village were in mourning. Maigret remembered one of his aunts when he was little, whom his father had asked why she'd bought yet another black dress.
"You see, my sister-in-law has breast cancer and might die in a few months or a few weeks. It's so hard on clothes to have them dyed."
In a village, everyone has so many relatives who can die from one moment to the next that they all spend their lives in mourning clothes. Maigret was shaving, too. He saw the morning bus leave almost empty for La Rochelle, even though it was Saturday. Thérèse had brought him a cup of coffee and his hot water, because she'd seen him spend hours the previous evening off in his corner drinking wine, and then, after dinner, shots of brandy. It was not because he'd been drinking the evening before that he had a feeling of tragedy, either. Perhaps in the end, the reason was simply that he'd slept badly. He had spent the night seeing the faces of children, in close-up as in a film, faces that resembled the Gastin-Cellier boys, but were not exactly either one. He was trying, without succeeding, to remember those dreams. Someone was angry at him. One of the children, he didn't know which, they were all mixed up together. He kept telling himself that it was easy to recognize them, because the teacher's son wore glasses. Only immediately afterwards, he saw Marcel Cellier wearing glasses too, and when he expressed surprise about it, the boy told him,
"I only wear them when I go to confession."
It was doubtless not so tragic for Gaston to be in prison, since the police lieutenant did not believe that much in his guilt. Nor did the examining magistrate either. The teacher was better off over there for a few days, instead of in the village or confined to his house, and one witness report, especially that of a child, would not be enough to condemn him. To Maigret, it was more complicated than that. This often happened to him,
It could be said that during each new inquiry, his humour followed more or less the same curve. At the beginning, you see the people from the outside. It's their little troubles that stick out the most, and it's amusing. Then gradually, you get inside their skin. You wonder why they react in this way or that way. You catch yourself thinking as they do, and it becomes much less funny. Perhaps much later, when you've seen so much of them that nothing astonishes you anymore, it's possible to laugh at them, like Dr. Broussel. Maigret was not there yet. The kids preoccupied him. He felt that at least one of them, somewhere, must be living a kind of nightmare, in spite of the airy sunshine always bathing the village. He went downstairs to have breakfast in his corner, while carts were already delivering the inhabitants of the most distant farms to the square. The farmers did not come straight to the inn, forming dark groups in the street and in front of a church, and the flash of their shirts looked dazzling against their deep tans. He did not know who had arranged the funeral, had not thought to ask about that. In any case, the coffin had been brought from La Rochelle and placed directly in the church. The black shapes multiplied rapidly. Maigret noticed faces he'd not seen before. The lieutenant shook his hand.
Nothing new?
Nothing. I saw him yesterday evening in his cell. He still denies the charge. Just can't understand why Marcel Cellier insists on accusing him. Maigret went to the school courtyard, where there were no classes that day, and the windows of the teacher's house were closed. No one was visible. Surely the mother and son would not attend the funeral, but stay at home, silent, fearful, expecting trouble. Yet the crowd did not seem angry. The men called to one another. A few of them began entering Louis' place for a quick one, and reappeared, wiping their lips. As the inspector passed, all fell silent, then began to speak in low voices as they followed him with their eyes. Wearing a tightly belted raincoat, even though the sky was clear, a young man came up to him with an outsized pipe in his mouth. "Albert Raymond, reporter à La Charente," he announced importantly. He wasn't more than 22, thin with long hair, his mouth twisted in a sarcastic smile. Maigret simply nodded. "I tried to come and see you yesterday, but I didn't have time." His words and demeanour made it clear that he considered himself the equal of the inspector. More precisely, that they were both outsiders to the crowd, both able to observe it from on high, as people in the know who have explored every last little corner of human nature. "Is it true," he asked, pad and pencil in hand, "that the teacher went to offer you his savings so that you'd get him out of trouble?" Maigret turned to him, looked him up and down, was about to open his mouth and then, with a shrug, turned his back on him. The fool was probably going to imagine that he'd struck home. It was of no importance. Bells were ringing. The women filled the entire church, along with a few men. There was a murmuring of organ music, the altar boy's bell.
"Will there be a mass, or only an absolution?" the inspector asked someone he did not know.
"A mass and an absolution. We have enough time."
Enough time to go and have a drink at Louis' place. Most of the men had gradually gathered in front of the inn, going inside in groups, standing around and downing a carafe of two, then coming back outside. There was constant coming and going, with men in the kitchen and even in the courtyard. Louis Pomel, who had found time to go inside the church, had removed his jacket and was hard at work, helped by Thérèse and a young man who seemed accustomed to lending him a hand. Cellier and his wife were attending the service. Maigret had not seen their son Marcel, but saw why a little later, when he entered the church in turn. Marcel was there, in the surplice of an altar boy, assisting at the mass. He must have been able to go directly to the sacristy, cutting through his parents' courtyard. Dies ire, dies illa. The women were moving their lips and actually seemed as if they were praying. Was it for the soul of Léonie Birard that they prayed, or for themselves? A few old men were at the back of the nave, hats in hand, and others came now and then to peek through the door to see how far along the service was. Maigret came back outside and noticed Théo, who, by way of a greeting, gave him his usual smile, dripping with irony. Someone certainly knew. Perhaps even several did and were keeping quiet. Inside the Bon Coin, voices were growing louder, and a lean farmer with a drooping moustache was already more than half drunk. The butcher as well, Maigret suspected, was walking less steadily, his eyes unusually bright, and Maigret saw him empty three big glasses with one man or another in the space of a few minutes. Less intrigued than the inspector, or more put off by the crowd's inquisitiveness, the lieutenant was keeping to the secretariat of the village hall, where the courtyard was empty around the linden. A cart passed, serving as a hearse and pulled by a chestnut horse with a black cloth over its back. The cart pulled up in front of the church, and the driver came over for a drink. There was a light breeze stirring. A few clouds way up in the sky gleamed like mother-of-pearl. Finally, the church doors opened. The drinkers rushed over. The coffin emerged, borne by four men, among whom Maigret recognized Julien Cellier and the deputy mayor. They hoisted it up onto the cart, not without difficulty. They covered it with a black cloth with a silver fringe. Then young Cellier appeared, carrying the silver cross at the end of a staff of black wood, and his surplice puffed up two or three times like a balloon. The priest followed, reciting prayers, finding the time to observe each person around him, and to stare for an instant at Maigret. Next came Julien Cellier and his wife, both in black, she with a crepe veil over her face. The mayor followed, a tall, strong man, composed, grey-haired, with an entourage of municipal councillors, and then came the bulk of the crowd, the men first, the women after them, and some, especially at the end of the cortege, dragging a child along by the hand. The young reporter came and went, taking notes, talking to people whom Maigret did not know. Advancing slowly, the cortege passed the Bon Coin, where Thérèse stood alone in the doorway, as Pommel had joined the group of councillors. For the second time that morning, Maigret was tempted to go and knock on the Gaston's door and talk to Jean-Paul. While all the others were going to the cemetery, weren't the mother and son feeling more alone than ever in the deserted village? He followed the rest for no particular reason. They passed Léonie Birat's house, then a farm where a calf in the yard began to bawl. At the entrance to the cemetery, there was some milling about, slightly disorganized. The priest and altar boy were already at the grave before everyone had entered the burial ground. That was when Maigret spotted a face looking over the wall. He recognized Jean-Paul. One of the lenses in his glasses was reflecting the sun, like a mirror. Instead of following the crowd, the inspector hung back and began walking around the cemetery, intending to reach Jean-Paul. Wouldn't the boy be too intent on what was happening around the grave to notice his maneuver? He was walking through a stretch of waste ground. When he was only about 30 meters from the child, he stepped on a dead branch. Jean-Paul instantly looked over in his direction, jumped off the stone he'd been standing on, and dashed towards the road. Maigret almost called after him, but the others would have heard him, so he simply quickened his pace, hoping to catch up with the boy along the way. It was a ridiculous situation, he realized that. He didn't dare run, neither did Jean-Paul. The child was even too scared to look back. He was in school clothes, doubtless the only one in the village not wearing his Sunday best. The boy probably wanted to go home, and thus ought to have passed by the gate to the cemetery, where there was a group of farmers. He turned left towards the sea, perhaps hoping that the inspector would not follow him. Maigret followed him. There were no more farms or houses, only fields and some meadows where a few cows were grazing. A hillock was still hiding the sea. The road was climbing slightly. The boy walked as fast as he could without running, and Maigret at his end lengthened his stride. He didn't even know exactly why he was pursuing the child like this, and quickly realized that it was cruel. To Jean-Paul, he must have represented a formidable power hot on his heels, but the inspector could hardly start shouting, "Jean-Paul, stop, I simply want to talk to you." The cemetery had disappeared behind them, along with the village. Cresting the hillock, the Gaston boy began going down the other side. Maigret saw only his upper body, then his head. An instant later, he saw nothing until he reached the hilltop himself, and then at last he discovered the shimmering expanse of the sea, with what looked to him like an island in the distance, or else the Pointe de l'Aiguillon, and a few fishing boats with brown sails seemingly suspended in space. Jean-Paul was still walking. There was no path to the left or right. At the shore stood 5 or 6 red-roofed shacks, where the mussel farmers stored their equipment. Maigret made up his mind.
"Jean-Paul!"
His voice sounded so strange that he barely recognized it, and turned around to make sure no one was watching him. He noticed a brief hitch in the child's pace. Surprise at his call had almost halted the boy in hesitation, but he was again walking as fast as ever, almost running, now in a panic. Feeling like a big brute tormenting a defenseless creature, the inspector was ashamed when he called out again,
"Hey, kid, stop!"
The most ridiculous part was that he was out of breath, and his voice was not carrying. he and the boy were still about the same distance apart. To get closer, he would have had to run. What was Jean-Paul hoping for? That Maigret would become discouraged and turn back? It was more plausible that he wasn't thinking at all, that he was hurrying straight ahead as if this were the sole way to escape from danger. At the end of the road, there was only the sea, with its shining fringe, rolling along the shingle beach.
Jean-Paul!
At this point, it would have been just as stupid to give up as to go on. The boy reached the shore, paused before following the path that must have led to the next village, and halted at last with his back to Maigret. Only when he heard the inspector's footsteps coming quite close did he turn to face him. He was not red, but pale, with pinched nostrils. He was clearly panting rapidly, lips parted, and you felt you could hear his heart beating like that of a bird held in your hand. Maigret said nothing. He could not find anything to say just then, and he, too, needed to catch his breath. Jean-Paul, no longer looking at him, had turned towards the sea. They both stared at it, and the silence lasted for a long time, as long as it took for their hearts to calm down to a steady pulse. Then Maigret walked a few steps to sit down on a pile of posts that smelled of fresh pine. He took off his hat, mopped his brow unashamedly, and very slowly filled a pipe.
"You walk fast," he finally murmured.
The boy, standing stiff-legged like a young rooster, did not reply.
"Won't you come over and sit near me?"
"I don't feel like sitting down."
"Are you angry?"
With a brief glance at him, Jean-Paul asked.
"Why?"
"I wanted to talk to you without your mother around. At your house, it's impossible. When I spotted you over the cemetery wall, I thought it might be a good opportunity."
He left long silences between his sentences to avoid spooking the boy.
"What were you looking at?"
"The people."
"You couldn't look at everyone all at once. I'm sure you were looking at someone in particular."
"Am I right?" Jean-Paul did not say yes or deny anything either.
"Do you usually go to church?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because my parents don't go."
With an adult, this would have been easier. It had been a long time since Maigret was a child. He had neither son nor daughter, yet he had to try to think like this boy.
"Did you tell your mother you were going out this morning?"
"No."
"You didn't want her to know?"
"She would have stopped me."
"You took advantage of her being upstairs to slip out quietly? And you made your way along the alleys?"
"I wanted to see."
"What?"
It wasn't the crowd, or the coffin being lowered into the grave. Maigret would have sworn to that. He remembered the surplice billowing in the breeze, the cross Marcel carried, recalled the time when he was barely 7 and wanted so much to be an altar boy. He'd had to wait 2 years. He too had carried the silver cross, trotting in front of a country hearse towards the cemetery.
"You wanted to see Marcel?"
He saw him give a start, with a child's astonishment at abruptly learning that a grown-up can read his mind.
"Why aren't you friends with Marcel?"
"I'm not friends with anybody."
"You don't like anybody?"
"I'm the teacher's son, I already told you."
"You'd rather be the son of the tinsmith or the mayor, or any farmer at all from the village?"
"I didn't say that."
He had to be careful not to frighten him, which might well have set him off again at a run. And yet it wasn't simply the fear of Maigret catching him again that was keeping the boy there. He was faster than the inspector. Now that they were face to face, did he not feel a kind of relief, and deep in his heart a secret longing to talk to someone?
"You still don't want to sit down?"
"I'd rather keep standing."
"Are you sorry that your father is in prison?"
Instead of replying no right away, he remained silent.
"You aren't sad about that?"
And Maigret felt as if he were stalking his objective, advancing only with infinite caution. He mustn't move too quickly. Even a single word could so threaten the child that he would reveal nothing further.
"Does it hurt you not to be like the others?"
"Why am I not like them? Who told you that?"
"Suppose I have a son who goes to school, plays in the neighborhood streets. His classmates would say he's the inspector's son. And because of that, they wouldn't treat him exactly like the other children. You see? You're the teacher's son."
The youngster shot him a longer look this time, more penetrating than before.
"Would you have liked to be an altar boy?"
He could tell he was on the wrong track. It was hard to say how he knew. Certain words provoked barely perceptible reactions. With others, it was as if Jean-Paul were closing up.
Does Marcel have friends?
Yes.
When they're together, do they talk quietly, exchange secrets, start laughing while they're looking at the rest of the kids?
That had come back to him from so long ago that it surprised him. It was the first time he felt that he was encountering such vivid memories of his own childhood, to the point of smelling the scent of the schoolyard back then, when the lilacs were in bloom.
Did you try to be their friend?
No.
Why not?
No reason.
You thought they wouldn't go along.
Why are you asking me these questions?
Because your father's in prison. He did not shoot at Léonie Birard.
He was studying the youngster's eyes, and the boy did not flinch.
You know perfectly well he didn't. Therefore, someone else did. Would you like your father to be convicted?
No. There had been a barely perceptible hesitation, and Maigret decided not to press the point. He had already considered that idea in his corner the previous evening, wondering if, deep in his heart, Jean-Paul might be angry at his father and mother for not being like the other parents. Not only because his father was a teacher. They did not go to church. They did not dress him like the other children. Their house was not like the other houses, either. And their life was different. His mother never laughed, but slipped around like a shadow, humble and repentant. She had done something very bad, and a woman had shot at her to punish her. That woman had not been convicted, which proved that she was right. Perhaps Jean-Paul loved them anyway. Whether he liked it or not, he belonged to the clan, was of their kind. All that was difficult to express. There were nuances that disappeared when things were put into words. Suppose you know something that's enough to get your father out of prison. With no idea himself where he was going, Maigret was surprised to see Jean-Paul look up abruptly to stare at him in a mixture of fright and admiration. The boy opened his mouth, almost spoke, but didn't, clenching his fists in the effort to control himself.
You see, I'm only trying to understand. I don't know your father well, but I'm convinced that he's a man who does not lie. He says that he did not set foot inside the tool shed on Tuesday morning. And I believe him.
Jean-Paul, still on the defensive, kept watching the inspector.
On the other hand, Marcel Cellier seems like a good boy. When he does happen to lie, he goes right away to confession so as not to remain in a state of sin. He has no reason to accuse your father, who, instead of being unfair to him, always grades him at the end of the class, when you should be there. Well, Marcel claims he saw your father coming out of a tool shed.
It was like a bubble rising suddenly to the surface of a pond. His head hanging, Jean-Paul said firmly, without looking at Maigret, "He's lying."
"You're sure he's lying, right? It isn't some vague feeling, and you aren't saying it from jealousy, either."
"I'm not jealous of him."
"Why didn't you say this sooner?"
"What?"
"That Marcel was lying."
"Because."
"You're certain that he did not see your father?"
"Yes."
"How come?"
Maigret had expected tears, perhaps shouting, but Jean-Paul's eyes were dry behind his glasses, except that his body had relaxed. There was no longer anything aggressive in his attitude. He was not even on the defensive anymore. The only sign of his surrender was that, feeling wobbly on his feet, he sat down a short distance from the inspector.
"I saw him."
"Whom did you see?"
"Marcel."
"Where? When?"
"In the classroom, near the window."
"Tell me precisely what happened."
"Nothing happened. Monsieur Piedbeuf came to get my father. They both went off towards the village hall office."
"You saw them?"
"Yes. I could see them from my seat. They disappeared through the arch at the entrance, and all the pupils began to fool around, as usual."
"You did not leave your bench?"
"No."
"You never misbehave?"
"I don't."
"Where was Marcel?"
"Near the first window on the left, the one that overlooks the schoolyard and the gardens."
"What was he doing?"
"Nothing. He was looking outside."
"He doesn't misbehave either?"
"Not often."
"Sometimes?"
"When Joseph is there."
"The butcher's son?"
"Yes."
"You were sitting at your desk. Marcel was near the left-hand window. Your father
and Monsieur Piedbeuf were in the office. That is correct.
Yes.
The windows were open.
They were closed.
You could still hear the noise from the forge?
I think so. I'm almost certain.
What happened?
Marcel left the window and crossed the classroom.
To go where?
To one of the two windows on the right.
The one from which you can see the rear of Madame Biard's house?
Yes.
Your father was still at the village hall at that moment?
Yes.
Marcel said nothing?
No. He looked out of the window.
Do you know what he was looking at?
From my seat, I couldn't see.
Do you usually watch Marcel?
Yes,
he admitted, embarrassed. This time, Maigret did not ask why. They were two good pupils, and because Jean-Paul was the teacher's son, the other one was top of the class. Marcel was an altar boy and wore a surplice on Sundays. Marcel had friends, had Joseph the butcher's son, with whom he whispered during playtimes, and at whose house he went to play after class. Did you see your father leave the village hall?
He walked towards our house and went inside to drink a cup of coffee.
Was the kitchen window open?
No. I know he had a cup of coffee. He always does.
Your mother was downstairs?
Upstairs, in my room. I could see her through the open window.
Your father, after that, did not go into the tool shed?
No. He crossed the courtyard to return to the classroom.
Marcel was still in front of the window, the one on the right?
Yes.
Why didn't you say so, right away?
When?
Maigret took the time to put his remembered evidence in order. Wait. Léonie Birard's body was discovered at the beginning of the afternoon. You children were not questioned right away.
We were not questioned that day. We didn't know exactly what was going on. We only saw people coming and going. Then we noticed the gendarme.
On Tuesday, in short, no one had openly accused the teacher. Marcel Cellier had not said anything, either to his parents or to anyone else. So Jean-Paul had no reason or chance to contradict him. Were you there the next day when they questioned Marcel?
No. They had us come to the office one by one.
And when he returned on Thursday morning? When did you learn that he claimed to have seen your father?
I don't remember any more.
On Tuesday evening. Did your parents talk about Léonie Béat?
Only after I was in bed. I heard part of what they were saying. My mother claimed that it was her fault. My father was saying that no, it was only rumours, that they would understand that he'd had nothing to do with it.
Why, when you learned that Marcel was accusing him, did you not protest?
They wouldn't have believed me.
Once again, Maigret thought he detected a nuance, a hint, something too subtle to be expressed. The youngster had not been glad to see his father accused. He had probably felt a certain shame at knowing he was in prison. But hadn't there been, on his part, a kind of cowardice? Hadn't he wanted, however slightly, without admitting it to himself, to distance himself from his parents? He resented them for not being like other parents. Well, now they were more different from them than ever, and the village, instead of keeping them at a distance, was turning against them. Jean-Paul envied Marcel. Was he going to accuse him in turn? In the end, he had not given in to a bad impulse. It was not cowardice, or in any case not simply cowardice. Couldn't one say that, on the contrary, it was a form of loyalty towards the others? He had the opportunity to contradict Marcel, to call him a liar. It was easy. Perhaps it seemed to him too easy. A cheap victory. Besides, the fact remained that no one would believe him. Who would have in the village if he'd shown up to say,
"Cellier lied. My father did not come out of a tool shed. I saw him go into the house, leave it, and cross the courtyard. And at that moment, Marcel was in front of the opposite window from which he couldn't see him."
You didn't say anything to your mother?
No.
Is she crying a lot?
She doesn't cry.
That was worse. Maigret imagined the atmosphere in the house over the last few days. Why did you come out this morning?
To see.
To see Marcel?
Maybe.
And perhaps, without realizing it, because of a need to participate, even from afar, in the life of the village. Wasn't he suffocating in that little house at the end of the courtyard, where they no longer dared open the windows?
Are you going to tell the lieutenant?
First, I have to see Marcel.
Will you be telling him I was the one who said something?
Would you rather he didn't know that?
Yes.
At heart, he'd not completely given up on being admitted one day to the select group of Marcel, Joseph, and the others.
I believe he will tell me the truth about my needing to bring you into it. Other classmates must have seen which window we were standing at.
They were fooling around.
All of them?
Except for one of the girls, Louise Boncoeur.
How old is she?
15.
She doesn't join in with the others?
No.
Do you think she was looking at Marcel?
For the first time, his face flushed, especially the ears.
She's always looking at him, he stammered.
Was it because she was in love with the tinsmith's son that she'd not contradicted him, or more simply, because she hadn't distinguished between one window and another?
Marcel had affirmed that he'd been standing near the window. His classmates had probably not thought about which window he meant.
We should be getting back to the village, observed the inspector.
I would rather not go back there with you.
Do you want to leave first?
Yes. Are you sure you won't say anything to Marcel?
Maigret nodded. The boy hesitated, touched his cap politely, began walking towards the meadows, and soon broke into a run. At the seashore at last, the inspector forgot to look at it and watched the figure moving away on the road. He set out in turn, stopped to fill his pipe, blew his nose, grumbled unintelligibly, and anyone seeing him walk slowly on his way would doubtless have wondered why he was shaking his head every now and then. By the time he passed the cemetery, the gravediggers had finished covering Léonie Birard's coffin with yellowish earth, and thanks to the fresh bouquets and floral wreaths, her plot could be seen from a long way off. Chapter 7. The Doctor's Forbearance. The women had gone home, and save for a few who lived at distant farms, they had probably already changed out of their black dresses and good shoes. As for the men, they remained, as on a country fair day, spilling out of Louis' Inn onto the pavement and into the courtyard, where they could be seen setting their bottles on a window ledge or an old iron table that had spent the winter there. From the pitch of the voices, the laughter, the slow clumsiness of the gestures, it was clear that they had had a lot to drink, and someone whose face Maigret could not see was relieving himself behind the hedge. Thérèse, bustling about, had found a moment to hand him a glass and a carafe. Only a few steps inside, he was now surrounded by conversations and caught sight of the doctor in the kitchen. But there were too many people in the way for the inspector to get to him just then.
"I'd never have thought we'd be planting her in the ground,"
an old man was saying, nodding his head. There were three of them, of about the same age. All three were certainly over 75, and in their corner they were standing in front of a sign on the white wall posting the laws regarding public drunkenness and the sale of alcoholic beverages. Dressed in starched shirts and their black Sunday suits, they had to stand more stiffly than usual, which gave them a certain solemnity. It was strange to discover, in their wrinkled and deeply creased faces, that when they looked at one another, their eyes took on a naive, childish expression. Each one was holding a glass. The tallest of the three, with magnificent white hair and a silky moustache, was swaying slightly, and whenever he wanted to say something, would place a finger on the shoulder of one of his companions. Why did Maigret imagine them suddenly in the courtyard of the school? In their laughter and the glances they exchanged, they were still schoolboys. They had gone to classes together. Later, they'd taken the same girls into the fields and attended one another's weddings, the funerals of their parents, the weddings of their children, and the baptisms of their grandchildren.
"She might almost have been my sister, because my father always told me that he tumbled her mother in the haystack time and again. She was hell of a female, it seems, and her husband was a cuckold his whole life."
Didn't that just sum up the village? Behind Maigret, in another group, someone was holding forth.
"When he sold me that there cow, I told him, 'Listen, Victor, I know you're a thief, but don't forget that we did our military service together in Montpellier, and that one evening—'"
Louis, who hadn't had time to change, had simply taken off his jacket. Maigret made his way along slowly, remembering that the doctor had invited him to lunch at home that day. Had Bressel forgotten? The doctor was holding a glass, like everyone else, but was keeping his head and trying to reason with a butcher, Marcelin, who was the drunkest man of all, and apparently quite agitated. It was difficult at that distance
to work out exactly what was happening. From what Maigret heard, Marcelin seemed to be railing against somebody, trying to push away the little doctor and get into the front room.
"I'm telling you I'm going to tell him!"
"Calm down, Marcelin, you're drunk."
"I got no right to be drunk, is it?"
"What did I tell you the last time you came for a checkup?"
"I don't give a damn."
"If you keep this up, the next funeral will be yours.
I won't be spied on. I'm a free man."
The wine was not doing him any favors. His face was white, with an unhealthy pink at the cheeks and eyelids. He could no longer control his movements. His voice was thickening.
"You heard me, Sawbones. I can't stand spies. Well, what's he doing here if not..."
It was Maigret he was looking at back there, and towards whom he was attempting to rush to tell him exactly what he thought. Two or three other men were watching him and laughing. Someone held out a glass, which the doctor seized first and poured out on the floor.
"Don't you see he's had enough, Fermat?"
Until then, there had been no arguments, no altercations. Basically, they all knew one another too well to fight, and each man knew exactly who was the strongest. Maigret avoided getting any closer, pretending not to notice what was going on so as not to aggravate the butcher. He kept an eye on the group, however, and witnessed a scene he found not a little surprising. The deputy mayor, Théo, tall and flabby, with his perpetually mocking eyes, now joined the others, brandishing a glass of not wine, but a Pernod so dark it must have had quite a kick. He spoke briefly and quietly to the doctor, then handed the glass to the butcher while placing a hand on his shoulder. He talked to him, too, and Marcelin at first appeared to struggle and be about to shove him away. Finally, he grabbed the glass, which he drained in one go, and almost immediately his gaze grew muddled, dull. He tried again to point a threatening finger at the inspector, but his arm had grown too heavy. Then, as if he had just knocked him out, Théo pushed him towards the stairs, where after a few steps up, he had to heave him onto his shoulder.
"You haven't forgot my invitation, have you?"
The doctor who had joined Maigret was sighing with relief, and said almost the same thing as the old man in the corner.
"They planted her in the ground. Are you coming?"
They both made their way out to the pavement and walked a few paces along.
"Within 3 months, it will be Marcelin's turn. I keep telling him, Marcelin, if you don't stop drinking, you'll croak. He's reached the point where he's stopped eating."
"He's ill."
"They're all ill in his family. He's a sad case."
"Did Théo go up to put him to bed?"
"We had to get rid of him somehow."
He opened his door. The house smelled of good cooking.
"Oh, you will have an aperitif?"
"I'd rather not."
The smell of wine had been so strong in Louis' inn that simply breathing the air could have made a man drunk.
"Did you attend the funeral?"
"At a distance."
"I looked for you coming out of a cemetery, but didn't see you. Is lunch ready, Armand?"
"In 5 minutes."
Only two places were set. Just like a priest's servant, the doctor's sister preferred not to sit at the table. She must have eaten standing in her kitchen, between two courses.
"Sit down. What do you think of it?"
"Of what?"
"Nothing. Everything. She had a first-rate funeral."
"The teacher is still in prison," grumbled Maigret.
"They had to put someone there."
"I'd like to ask you a question, Doctor. Among all those people at the funeral, do you think there were many who believed that Gaston killed Léonie Birard?"
"A few of them, surely. There are people who believe anything."
"And the rest?"
The doctor did not immediately grasp Maigret's point.
"Let's say that a tenth of the population is convinced that the teacher fired the gun," began the inspector.
"That's about right."
"The other 9/10 have their own ideas."
"No doubt about that."
"Whom do they suspect?"
"It depends. In my opinion, each of them suspects more or less sincerely the person they'd most like to be guilty."
"And no one is talking about it?"
"They must be, among themselves."
"Have you heard of any suspicions along those lines?"
The ironic look the doctor gave him might almost have come from Théo.
"They don't tell me that sort of thing."
"Yet knowing or believing that the teacher is not guilty, it doesn't bother them that he's in prison?"
"Certainly not. Gaston is not of a village. They feel that if the lieutenant and the examining magistrate have judged it wise to arrest him, that's their business. That's what they're both paid to do."
"They'd let him be convicted?"
"Without batting an eye."
If it were one of theirs, then that would be a different story. Are you beginning to understand? Once a guilty culprit is required, it might as well be a stranger.